Well, from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. And it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. Of course, we're going to get you updated on all the news that made headlines this last week. Our panelists this week, Kevin Richert, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Also, we are following a developing story right now as the Valley Fire is burning in East Boise near Warm Springs Avenue. The Bureau of Land Management, along with other fire agencies, responded to this fire when it was reported shortly after 4 a.m. this morning. So as of right now, at noon today, since we do come on live at noon, but of course you'll hear this again at 8 p.m. tonight. You could also hear this in a podcast. So things could be different when you are listening to this. But as of noon right now, that fire is burning more than 2,500 acres. And if you are familiar with that area, there are multiple housing developments in that area. In fact, our senior producer, Samantha Wright, has been following this story all morning, and she's joining us now with an update. So, Sam, as I said, we are talking about current information as of 12 p.m. on Friday.
That's right, Gemma. And, you know, I got to say, our officers here at the radio station are on Park Center Boulevard in Boise. And when I stepped outside a few minutes ago, there was actually a light ash falling in the parking lot. There is ash.
Oh, wow.
From this fire following in the parking lot. And you can see the smoke everywhere. Our engineers are actually up on Deer Point doing some work. They're reporting there's a ton of smoke up there, and of course you can see it all across the valley. So let's get specific. This fire is to the left or to the west of Lucky Peak Reservoir along Highway 21 near Highland Valley Summit. This is in southeast Boise, still in the Boise limits. And as you said, it is near subdivisions along Warm Springs Avenue. It started sometime before 4 a.m. because it was 25 acres, according to the Idaho Statesman at that point. And since then, as you said, it's grown to 2,500 acres.
So, Sam, what do we know in regards to any road closures? I'm assuming there have been some, at least.
Right. So the Idaho State Police is reporting that there have been some road closures. Highway 21 is closed at Warm Springs Road. Warm Springs Road is closed between Eckert Road and Highway 21. And if you run into those closures, only local residents will be allowed in. Otherwise, you can't get in there.
So, Sam, I heard that just for precaution's sake, they closed schools. We should note there are three schools in that area.
Right. Boise School District has announced they're closing East Junior High School and Dallas Harris Elementary School because of the fire and because of smoke. And if any of your kids were on a bus when they announced that, they were taken to Lebois Junior High, and they're asking parents to pick up their kids there. Also, Riverstone International School closed down due to the fire as well.
So, Sam, what do we know about the response to the fire so far? I mean, like, as I mentioned in the introduction, as we started the program, the Bureau of Land Management did respond to this fire. But, I mean, it's, you know, continuing to grow right now.
Right. And a lot of people are working on the fire. So KTVB has been reporting they saw helicopters that were dropping water on the fire. We know there are five BLM engines out there so far, two dozers, at least one investigator who's working the fire. We don't know how it started. And we should point out there is no containment time listed for this fire, but we have heard that there are some pre-evacuation notices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talk to us about that, Sam, these pre-evacuation notices and what we know so far about this.
So KTVB also reports Boise Fire Department sent out what's called pre-evacuation notices. These are for residents in the Warm Springs area. Now, that means folks in those areas should not evacuate right now, but they should be ready to leave at any moment. Specifically for the pre-evacuation notices, that's residents on Warm Springs from East Skybar Street, east of Highway 21, and then all residents on Highland Valley Road. And I think you even have more on this.
I do. So according to the Boise County Sheriff's Office, Sam, at 11 a.m. this morning, they actually posted on their Facebook page that the Boise County Sheriff's Office is putting Roby Creek residents at a level one evacuation because of the Valley County, because of the Valley Fire. So that means that because there are different levels, different evacuation levels. So the stage one is it's be ready, right? So like if we tell you to go, you need to go. So this is kind of a level higher than what they're telling residents along Warm Springs. The other thing that the Boise County Sheriff's Office pointed out, Sam, that I think is important to talk about is that they've said there's been a lot of mixed reporting on Highway 21 being opened or closed. So the Boise County Sheriff's Office, again, at 11 a.m., said that it appears that Highway 21 is open right now. But of course, that is subject to change. And so, Sam, we should also tell folks that, I mean, if you do not need to be in that area right now, stay out of it. There aren't a lot of endpoints and outpoints along Warm Springs and once you get to Highway 21. So, you know, if for some reason you had, you know, plans out in that area today, I think it's really critically important that folks know to stay out of that area.
Right. Don't go on the roads and, you know, unless you live there and it's vital, because you're just going to get in the way and that's going to cause trouble. It's busy out there. We've seen a lot of pictures, a lot of good mm-hmm. pictures of people who have taken pictures of the fire and the smoke. There are pictures being released by Idaho State Police, where they've blocked the roads and encouraging people just don't go there if you don't have to.
So Sam, one other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is the fact that Idaho Power, cut the power in the area. So first, let's talk about when they did that and how many folks are being impacted by this.
Okay, the Idaho Statesman reported that the Idaho Power folks were out at 9:30. They turned off the power in the area of the fire. Obviously, this is for the safety of the firefighters and the residents. And a lot of power companies have adopted new programs like this. Idaho Power, theirs is called PSPS. It's called a public safety power shutoff. They cut the power ahead of time when they can, when a wildfire is threatening an area like it is now, or if there's high fire risk, say if it's really windy. Some people, we heard about this in Boise, they experienced this earlier this summer when Idaho Power cut the electricity to some areas on a really, really windy night because they were worried that a fire might start, so they cut the power, and the idea is to stop wildfires from starting or spreading. Because if the fire, if the power's on and the wind knocks down a power line, say, it could start a fire or add to a fire that's out there. And this is usually a safety issue, but it's becoming a lot more common. And this comes after a string of lawsuits against power companies. After big fires like the one in Hawaii, and we actually did a segment on this, Gemma, where we had a reporter coming on to talk about how some of the power companies are doing this now preemptively to protect themselves from liability along with safety. And I think it's a fascinating subject, and I think we're going to see this more and more often as you know, extreme fire danger happens.
Right. So again, Sam, it's good that the Idaho Power has done this. And even though with the inconvenience of it for people not having power, it is a safety issue because as you mentioned, the Lahaina fire in Maui, also the Paradise fire in California, mm-hmm. I think a lot of power companies are at least, you know, learning from that, right? And taking hopefully preemptive steps in these situations.
Definitely. And along with the fact that you need to cut the power so that the power lines might fall on a firefighter. And you know, if they're active, that could be deadly. So that's, you know, that's the other reason. I should point out, Idaho Power actually has a PSPS map on its website. You can actually look and see areas that the company is focusing on. They also do phone calls, texts, email. I heard from some folks who got some texts back earlier this summer when their power was going to be cut. So they had some warning, you know, so they knew it was going to happen. For this fire we're talking about right now, the Valley Fire, we should note fire has burned some of the wooden power poles in the area we're talking about. And most of the power poles out there are wood. So when Idaho Power does start looking to turn the power back on when the fire danger is past, this could take a while to get up and running to get power back to folks because power poles have actually burned and the power lines are down in some areas.
Mm-hmm. So, Sam, just to be, let's go back to where we are now, right now, because I'm also looking at Boise Fire Department, their update at 11:53 a.m. Mm-hmm. So again, folks, we are live. This could change by the time you listen to this. But I want to read what the Boise Fire Department just posted at 11:53, that the fire jumped the line. So a code red set notification has now been sent out to Council Springs, Trapper, PI, Foxgrove neighborhoods. So they say pack your emergency items in your vehicle and be ready to evacuate. So this is an incredibly serious situation that is going on. Lots and lots of homes, neighborhoods, schools, businesses out in that East Boise area.
And they're tucked in all over out there. And mm-hmm. and it's a scary situation. And this, we have had, in the past, one death from a wildfire that ended up in a Boise subdivision on the outskirts of town. This was several years ago. So it is
right,
not.
That was the Amity Fire, Sam. Right? Yeah, August of 2008.
Right. So it's not. Right. This has happened. So this is a serious, serious thing. Folks in the area need to be ready and to keep their eyes open. And if you don't need to be in the area, stay away.
Yeah. And we will, of course, make sure that we continue to update as much as possible on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. But I would also highly recommend that you get on to social media and you follow like the Boise Police Department, Boise County Fire, Boise Fire Department. They are updating continually. So those are really good sources of information as well. If you A, live in that area, but B, you know folks in that area or have loved ones in that area, just to keep yourselves updated. And like I said, we will do our best as well. And I want to get to a story that so many folks have been talking about. And this is the fact that college volleyball games normally don't get much attention, let alone national attention. That is not the case this last week when Boise State forfeited a game against San Jose State. It made headlines. The issue was a transgender athlete. So Kevin, with that said, tell us what happened and what BSU has had to say about this decision to forfeit that game.
Well, what happened, we know, is that Boise State very abruptly on Friday afternoon announced that they were forfeiting this match against San Jose State. And Boise State has said basically nothing about the reasons behind that decision. But pretty clearly and pretty quickly, the speculation went straight to the fact that San Jose State has a player who has been named in a lawsuit and identified in a lawsuit as a transgender athlete. Boise State is not the first university to forfeit a match against San Jose State. Southern Utah forfeited a match earlier in September. Since then, since Boise State's announcement, the University of Wyoming and Utah State University also have canceled matches with San Jose State. So now you're up to four universities that have either forfeited or canceled matches. So this is a growing firestorm. And this has been a very contentious issue for several years. There's mm-hmm. been a federal lawsuit that's been going on for months challenging the NCAA on allowing transgender athletes to participate in women's sports. The Idaho legislature passed a bill 4 years ago on transgender athletes, a ban on transgender athletes participating in women's sports. That law has been mired in courts ever since. Governor Brad Little issued an executive order in late August, again, kind of emphasizing, fairness in women's sports, which has been kind of the rallying cry on this whole issue. So there's a lot of politics around it. And that's why I spent some of this week writing about volleyball, which we don't normally do. We don't normally write mm-hmm. about athletics, but this is not an athletics issue. This is a social issue. It's an education policy issue, probably about as emotional an education and sports issue as we have right now.
So Kevin, what I found interesting too about your analysis in the article that you wrote, though, is really We don't know, except for the fact that, yes, there was a transgender athlete at San Jose State, who decided to forfeit the game. Was it the players? Was it BSU's administration? So what has Boise State said in regards to why this decision was made?
Nothing. Nothing. I mean, they've said nothing about the reasons for the decision, and they've said nothing about who made the decision. And that is a big distinction. You know, if the players voted to forfeit the match, well, that's one thing. But if administration made this decision and kind of ordered the Boise State to forfeit this, or if the administration even had kind of a role in saying and kind of, influencing the decision or being involved in the conversation, well, that becomes a whole different issue as well. We don't know where this decision originated, but we do know that this is a highly politically charged issue. So it's certainly there's room for speculation as to who made the decision and what drove the decision.
Mm-hmm. And you talk also, Kevin, about transparency in this, and the fact that we need to have transparency. We're talking about, millions upon millions of dollars going to this university. So can you kind of talk a little bit more about that and the fact that, this is a public institution and they have, it was 48 words that they have said, literally 48 words?
Yeah, I counted. 48 words. And again, this is a public institution. This is the largest public university in the state. And let's be real here. This university has faced a considerable amount of backlash in the state house over campus politics, over DEI, over social justice. Now, that has been an issue that has followed Boise State University for years. It's been kind of an issue that's plagued President Marlene Trump since her arrival here 5 years ago. And we are just less than a month removed from Boise State administrators being, taking a real hit in a courtroom about a month ago in the Big City Coffee lawsuit, where you had a jury determine the two university administrators owed $4 million in damages over Big City Coffee's departure from campus. So all of that, all of the political overtones, I think that even, underscores the lack of any kind of transparency, the lack of any kind of explanation from the university. It's hard not to look at this decision and the political reactions to this decision and not look at it against the broader context of higher education politics and the backlash over Boise State University at the state house.
Melissa, you've been covering this issue for years, and I am curious about this political response to this decision to forfeit. But what can you tell us really about where the legislature itself stands on this issue?
The legislature has overwhelmingly made it clear that it supports the 2020 law that was sponsored by Representative Barbara Ehart, that's a blanket ban on transgender girls and women in sports at public institutions. And of course, that law, as we talked about, has been embroiled in lawsuits since then, but Republican lawmakers overwhelmingly in the state have said, we don't think that there's a place for transgender girls and women in sports. We have concerns about safety. We don't trust the NCAA or the individual governing bodies for these athletic associations to make their own policies, which they have been doing, by the way, long before these laws have been passed in Idaho and elsewhere. We don't think those go far enough. The sponsor of that bill, Representative Barbara Ehart, is a longtime NCAA women's basketball coach. I mean, she is, women's sports are her life. Title IX, she's said multiple times, has made a big, big difference in her life. And she wasn't satisfied with the policies that these individual athletic associations were making. And those, you know, vary from institution to institution, athletic governing body to body. But overall, you can expect that athletes are expected to submit test results on testosterone levels and that sort of thing. So it's not like it's, for the most part, the Wild West, or it wasn't before these laws were passed. These athletic governing bodies did have policies. The International Olympic Committee has had policies since, I think, 2002 or 2003. It's not a new conversation in athletics. The difference is the state government getting involved. And that's what we saw with the Fairness in Women's Sports Act in 2020.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, Melissa mentioned Representative Barbara Ehart. I mean, she responded to Boise State's decision to forfeit this game, correct?
Right. So a lot of Boise State's adversaries in the State House are praising Boise State for this decision, including Representative Ehart, who has been about as outspoken a critic, not just of transgender athletes on the playing field or on the volleyball court or the basketball court. She has been a pretty outspoken critic of all forms of social justice spending on college campuses. She's been a leading opponent of higher education budget bills when they've come across the House floor. She praised the decision. The Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has basically made a cottage industry out of criticizing Marlene Trump and criticizing Boise State, they praised the decision. So you've got this sort of, you know, odd alliance here where folks who have been very critical of Boise State's politics are supporting this particular decision that has never really been fully explained publicly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point, Kevin, my understanding is that the Idaho Freedom Foundation is telling people to go to the next home volleyball game at Boise State.
Yeah, right. They linked to the ticket department in one of their social media posts about this. So, yeah, very strange politics about this. And I, yeah, again, I have to wonder to what degree did political pressure play any role, or political, you know, overtones play any role in the decision that was made at Boise State. But again, it goes back to, you know, who made the decision. We still don't know that even.
I want to say something about the, you know, linking to buy tickets to the women's volleyball game. And I think, you know, anyone who knows me or follows me on social media knows that I'm a huge sports fan and a huge women's sports fan. I have noticed that, you know, with Representative Barbara Ehart aside, I mean, she's very involved in women's sports and has been for decades.
Yeah, there are
a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, this is her life. There are a lot of people who are saying, you know, we stand behind women athletes. We support women's athletics. I don't know if they've ever been to a professional women's sporting event. And I think
even a collegiate women's sporting event, Melissa,
collegiate, any of that. And, you know, we have great women athletes at the college level in this state, fantastic professional women athletes in this, you know, broader Northwest region. And I would just say to that, you know, regardless of where people stand on this issue, aside from that, I think it's a shame that the only time that we are talking about women's sports on this, you know, in very public platforms for the most part, is in relation to this issue. It, you know, regardless of where people stand on this, I would hope that they show up to the game, show up to the BSU women's basketball home opener in November. You know, the BSU gymnastics team won the Mountain West Championship this spring, the inaugural one this spring. The women's basketball team has won 5 championships in the last decade. There's more to women's sports, and there's more to supporting women athletes than saying we don't want transgender women playing.
Right. I think that's such a good point, Melissa, because, you know, it seems that, as you said, when we start talking about women's sports is when there was an issue like this, instead of the fact that we have incredibly successful women's collegiate teams just here in the state of Idaho. And with that said, Melissa, I know that, you know, as we mentioned, you've covered this issue for a very long time. What have you learned over the years about the athletes' stance on this issue? Because this wasn't like they just forfeited any game. This is a conference game. So this impacts their standing.
And therefore affects other teams' standings as well. And right. I think, you know, just like there's no one unified opinion between women on any issue, women athletes disagree on this. Absolutely. You know, you're going to find different opinions within the same team. There are some women who are, you know, genuinely concerned about their safety if they're playing against somebody who, you know, say went through male puberty and their testosterone levels are higher. And there are women who say, you know what, bring it on. The athlete in question isn't even the tallest woman on her team.
Right.
You know, there are women who are her height on the BSU women's volleyball team. Last night, you know, SJSU played in Colorado, in Fort Collins, and they lost. And so you're not going to find one unified opinion on this. And I think that's why this conversation requires so much nuance.
Mm-hmm.
It requires science. It requires listening to athletes and coaches and understanding that there are going to be a variety of opinions on here. It's not black and white in the athletic world. You'll find that in interviews, regardless of which sport we're talking about, whether it's weightlifting or boxing or basketball or softball, people have different opinions. And I think it's a shame that, you know, going back to BSU, not saying who made the decision and why. When you don't have that explanation, it creates a vacuum where some of the most divisive voices end up being the loudest.
Mm-hmm. And Melissa, it's my understanding that Boise State played this team in previous seasons, right? And don't they have another game slated to play against San Jose State coming up later this season?
I'd have to look at their schedule, but they have played San Jose before in other seasons. And, you know, this athlete isn't a new athlete on the team.
I know part of the answer to that, Gemma. Yes, San Jose State is scheduled to play at Boise State on November 21st.
Okay, right. So we'll see if scheduled. So we'll see what happens come November 21st and whether they forfeit again. But appreciate the nuance of this conversation beyond just they forfeited this game and truly the political, you know, the politics of this, but also the athletes. And Melissa, you make such a good point about the fact that maybe we should be listening to these athletes more, wherever they fall on this issue, right? They're the ones who are the most impacted by these decisions.
And certainly Representative Ehart, you know, has spoken to athletes. She has toured with athletes who agree mm-hmm. with her on this stance. But there are so many athletes and there are so many opinions. And, you know, meanwhile, the NCAA has had their own policies and they continue to tweak those policies. This isn't the end of the conversation. And I just also have to give a shout out to Idaho State and UI and all of the other collegiate athletes in the state. ISU winning the Big Sky Softball Championship this past spring. there are so many good teams in this state. And we don't have to wait for a controversy to support women athletes.
I 100% agree. We have enjoyed quite a few BSU women's soccer games over the years, especially when my kids were younger and they were playing. And it was a lot of fun to go out there and watch them play. So Kevin, some big changes to the Empowering Parents program. First, can you just remind us what that program is?
Yeah, so this is going to be the third year for Empowering Parents. And it's a microgrant program that helps parents and families pay for out-of-pocket education costs. So we could be talking about a laptop. We could be talking about athletic uniforms, pay-to-play fees, physical therapy, occupational therapy, the list goes on. Well, the big change to this week is that there's going to be a new company in charge of administering this $30 million program. It's a familiar name, and this is really mm-hmm. wonky. The contractor names are interesting only to me and a handful of people who who actually care about the contracting process closely. Class Wallet is an outfit out of Florida. They ran the original version of this program back during the pandemic. They will replace a company named Odyssey, which is based in New York, which had a really kind of a rocky 2-year period running the Empowering Parents program. You'll remember we've talked about this before. There was an internal state review because there were reports that parents were using the money for items that are not eligible for a taxpayer reimbursement. I mean, stuff like, you know, TVs and smartwatches and clothing and the like. Governor Brad Little asked for an external audit. Now, his audit revealed that there really weren't that many improper purchases, but you had the cloud of these two reviews. You had the state demanding Odyssey return money to the state because they'd collected interest on the federal account that was paying for these micro grants. So really checkered past for Odyssey. They're out. This new company is back in. Class Wallet is back in as the contractor. What matters maybe most to people who are listening, the application window will reopen probably later in October. So if you're listening to this and you want to get in on an application for the grants, that's when that window opens. It's targeted largely towards folks under $60,000 in household income. Then it goes up to $75,000, and then it becomes a first come first serve basis. So it's targeted, and based largely on income. But the application season should start in the next few weeks.
Okay, I appreciate that update. So Melissa, Idaho Reports is back on the air come October 18th. But we won't be seeing any candidate debates this election season?
Sadly, no. We would have potentially had two congressional debates. Of course, you know, congressional districts 1 and 2 are on the ballot. And in the past, we have had a lot of luck at Idaho Public Television and with the Idaho debates partners getting incumbents to agree to debate their opponents with very few exceptions. It wasn't the case this time. Both Representative Fulcher and Representative Simpson declined to debate or missed our deadlines to respond. Now, the flip side of that is we can't have a debate with just one candidate, but we can invite the Democratic candidates to be on Idaho Reports, which we are doing. That's tentatively scheduled for our first show with Kaylee Peterson and David Roth, CD1 and CD2, respectively, for our October 18th show.
Okay. And then I also want to talk about your, October 25th show around Prop 1. Okay. Because this is something where lots of people have lots of questions about this.
Yeah, so many questions. And, you know, I think of all of the Idaho issues that are going to be on the ballot, except for a couple, potentially tight legislative races, this is the big talker for Idaho. Prop 1, we have an entire half hour dedicated to it. We're going to have both pros and cons explaining in depth what it does for both the primary and the general elections, as well as a breakdown of potential costs and how, you know, the reasons why we won't know exactly how much it could cost until and if it does pass. So that is scheduled for October 25th. We'll also have an explainer this season before the election of the constitutional amendment on non-citizens not being able to vote. We'll have a brief explainer on that and a breakdown on November 2nd of all of those hot legislative races that we're going to be watching and why they matter, regardless of where you live in the state.
All right. Well, looking forward to all of that. It's such good information. So, Kevin, this school year, you yourself are following this new popular phenomenon of a 4-day school week. So what are you finding in regards to why this is becoming so popular? And we should note that one of the largest school districts in the state, the Nampa School District, has adopted this change. I mean, my kids would love this. I would hate this.
Well, everybody's got an opinion about it, and that's
you're right.
Part of what I'm going to try to get into in the next school year. Before we get into the whys, I am really struck by the how many we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Melissa and I have had this conversation because I did a series about 4-day schools almost 10 years ago, and back then I thought it was a phenomenon that we had almost 30,000 kids around the state in 4-day schools. We are almost certainly going to be in excess of 100,000 students in 4-day schools across the state. That's about a third of all kids in the K-12 system. It's really mushroomed for a lot of different reasons. And you mentioned NAMPA. That's a big reason why we're hitting the 100,000 student mark. NAMPA, which has over 12,000 students, it's the fourth largest district in the state. They've gone to the four-day calendar. What I really want to do this year, because of the growth of four-day schools and because of the growing controversy about four-day schools, this was a big issue during the 2024 legislative session. I want to look at how is this working and how is this working for kids? What effect is this having on student performance, on test scores, on go on rates? You know, how is this affecting teacher recruitment and retention? Because that's become a big issue in this and a big reason why a lot of districts like NAMPA are looking at the four-day calendar. They think it makes it easier to recruit teachers and keep the teachers that are doing a good job in the classroom. NAMPA's worried that they lose too many teachers to Boise and West Ada. They're worried that they have been losing teachers to some of the other rural districts that have been on the four-day calendar. They think they've got a market niche now to hang on to teachers. So we want to run the numbers. We want to look at, is this having an effect on teacher retention? Is it having an effect on student attendance rates, absentee rates? We really want to crunch the numbers because the research has been pretty spotty at the state level and at the national level. So we want to try to answer some questions about how this is affecting kids, how it's affecting parents, how it's affecting employees, how it's affecting communities. Because as you said, everybody has an opinion because everybody has a stake in it. You know,
yeah.
The school schedule affects your entire community. You know, it is a linchpin in your community. So we're going to take a hard look at it, hopefully get out on the road, talk to some folks on all sides of the issue.
So, Kevin, I only have like a minute left, but I'm curious. So do they expand the school day when they go to a four-day schedule?
Yes.
Or does,
yes.
Okay, so you're getting the hours in.
Right. The state requires every school to have a certain number of hours per school year. And you can do that over 4 days. You can do it over 5 days. And that's been the standard for years. So yes, if you go to a four-day calendar, your day tends to start earlier and tends to run later, which raises a lot of issues, especially with younger kids. I mean, you know, younger kids in an all-day kindergarten in a four-day school, they're putting in some serious hours during the course of the day, but they will then have Friday off. So it's a trade-off.
Well, little kindergartners are exhausted no matter what, right? I think if it's a four-day school week or a five-day school week, but yeah, well, I'm fascinated to learn more about this, Kevin, and the reporting that you do on this. Like you said, every community has a stake in this. In particular, you know, as a parent, I'm thinking about this a lot as well. So looking forward to that reporting.
And I'd love to come back and talk about it more. I'm charged up about it, as you can tell.
Well, we will definitely hold you to that and have you come on and talk more about it. With that said, I want to thank both of you for coming on. I know how busy you guys are, so really appreciate you taking time. A big thank you to Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. And a special thank you to our senior reporter, Samantha Wright, who joined us at the beginning of the program to talk about the Valley Fire in East Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.